All right, all you movie junkies, it is time for the SLS Cast with your hosts, Matt and Tim.
And welcome, 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 one and all, to episode 38 of the SLS Cast. Yes, episode 38, an interesting number, one that was the calling code assigned to Yugoslavia.
Why did they get stuck with 38? Why
I have
not
no
like
idea. We're talking about a country that had one of the worst cars ever developed named after it. The Yugo.
The Yugo.
Yeah, it was a compact car. It was kind of like the 1984 version of the Mini Cooper.
Uh-huh.
And yet it was just this terrible performing car, but it was just so cheap. At the time, it was like less than $2,000 or something. And so they were moving like $1,000 a week. It was ridiculous. And the guy who worked out the distribution deal was just making money hand over fist for several years while that was going on. And I just, when I saw that, all I could think of was the Yugo. And yet somehow I thought, we should just talk about Yugoslavia for a little bit.
We should.
And we did. So I am Matt.
And I am Tim.
And how have you been doing, sir?
I've been doing pretty well. My legs are a bit sore. My jaw is a bit numb. I went to the FYF Festival, also known as Fuck Yeah Fest. It's a big festival that they do every year out in LA, right in downtown, right next to Chinatown. And it's basically supposed to be a festival with music, but it's supposed to kind of be a symbolic gesture for the metro rail line and the bus stops and the buses themselves to kind of like get people to use public transportation instead of being able to drive, since it is easily accessible to the metro and the buses and all that good stuff. So it was pretty cool. One thing that I did, which is kind of the reason why I do have the sore legs, is because I stood in one place for 7.5 hours. We got there right when the gates opened, and the bands that we really wanted to see were all playing at the same stage. So of course we get there, it's 2:30 when the gates open, and our bands don't even start playing until 4:30. We wait in line to get in for about 45 minutes. We get to the stage where we're gonna be seeing these people play, and we just sit there for 2.5 hours waiting for this one band to start playing. And then it's not for another 3-4 hours until the band that we actually want to see starts to play. And pretty much before we know it, you know, we were standing for about 7.5 hours up in the front, which is pretty cool. And then dealing with all the crazy young kiddos just pushing into you, trying to do the wave and crowd surfing and all those shenanigans and all that stuff. It was time well worth spent. So, do you ever go to the festivals, or have you ever been to a concert festival of some sort, Matt?
Yes, I used to do Lollapalooza back in the day.
So you were one of the original Lollapaloozers.
Yeah, I was a Lollapaloozer, and that's why I no longer go.
Well, that's back when they had like actual like terrific bands playing.
They did. They had some interesting stuff. We got to see Sinead O'Connor when she was attempting to make a return. Initially, another big festival that I used to go to quite frequently was Bumbershoot out in Seattle. Would do some country music festivals every so often, but I gotta be honest with you, I can't think of the last time that I went to a music festival. It's definitely been a while.
Well, I think it's also difficult to find a music festival that actually has bands that you really want to go see all at once, because it seems like you look at some festivals and it's like, okay, well, out of 20 bands playing, there are maybe 2 or 3 that I really want to go see, and whether or not that's actually worth going. Because the thing about FYF is that there were 2 bands that we really wanted to go see. One was Beach House, and the other one was MGMT, which I absolutely love their music. However, the stuff that you stand on, it's not grass. It's not like on a grassy field where this festival was at. It was on dirt. So by the end of the concert, with the thousands upon thousands of people that were attending the festival, it just seems like dust clouds were everywhere, and everybody was just kicking up so much dust and dirt everywhere. So by the time we left, just our throats and our lungs were just completely covered with grimy grime brownness.
Did I miss why Your jaw hurts? I guess I get why your legs would hurt. You were standing for hours on end, but why was your jaw not feeling so great?
Go getting hit by people, getting run into, because this kind of music, like Beach House and MGMT, this isn't hard rock at all. This is like swaying music. This is indie pop, psychedelic music. So you don't necessarily jump and headbang to this stuff. However, some people don't realize that, well, there are music that you can just actually sway to, or you can just actually stand still and just enjoy it. But no, a lot of people now, they will jump and run into people, mosh to any kind of music. And this is what they were doing. And Chelsea and I were just kind of standing there, and we were just enjoying the music, swaying, holding each other, and it was just a very immersive experience. And then people just start swaying too much, like kind of overcompensating for how much the other people were pushing them from the back. And so we were kind of getting crushed between the people pushing us and the gate that we were kind of leaning against. So I think just one too many people punched my face during the concert. So I think that kind of led to the lockjaw today.
Okay. I just, that still doesn't make any sense. If this is swaying music, who the hell's hitting you in the face?
Everybody else. That's the thing.
They misunderstood sway with mosh and hit you in the face?
These people were younger than us. Like, I think we were honestly the oldest people in the big jumble of people in the front.
Aren't you like 20?
Because it was all like high schoolers that were up there.
Okay.
And they don't understand. Yeah, they just don't understand that it's okay just to listen to music. They all have to get violent at these things, which, you know, if we were watching Metallica or something, and of course I would expect to experience a couple blows to the face, but not to fucking Beach House.
Yeah,
man, that shit is chill.
See, even Metallica, I gotta say, I don't know, because if at the average age of the band, the median age of the band is an age at which a normal person can't mosh, then I don't think you should mosh at that concert either. And when you think of a band like Metallica, where the median age is 44, I don't think most 44-year-olds are going to go in a mosh pit. But that's just me. Maybe because I'm old. I don't know. But to be clear, you're 25, right?
Correct.
Man, some high school
kids
need to get a life.
I know, I kind of sound like I'm more like 45 or something.
I'm just thinking some high school kids need to get a life. I don't
yeah,
I don't know.
But these are also the people that whenever they listen to music, they don't pay attention to the lyrics. A lot of them only pay attention to the sound. If it has a poppy, fun, dancing sound to it, they're going to dance to it, not really taking any consideration for the lyrics, for the whole tone of the song, and anything like that. I mean, somebody could be talking about how depressing their life is, but if there's a fun, boppy tone to it, then people will dance to it. Nonetheless, we had a very good time. The night was a success. How about you? How was your past week?
Well, it was not anywhere near as exciting. My jaw feels great. The legs are fine. But the most exciting thing that happened to me in the last week was getting to play Final Fantasy XIV: A Realm Reborn. It's the second attempt for Square Enix to launch an MMO based on the Final Fantasy franchise. I've also got Final Fantasy XIII dropped into the Xbox 360 and been playing some Disney Infinity. As a matter of fact, we actually have people coming over on Saturday night, friends from work and stuff. We're having a party. The point of the party, because I normally have game night on Saturday nights, and the board game has been replaced with Disney Infinity. Now everybody's coming over so we can build a huge level in our toy box.
That sounds creepy.
My poor kid. She's like, but Daddy, it's my game. Not anymore. Not tonight, it's not.
Is this going to be kind of like World of Warcraft, where Disney Infinity will ruin your relationship with your child?
No, because the idea is that we get to play together. And when she wants to play that on her own, that'll be fine as well, because then I can come and play my Final Fantasy XIV.
A Realm Reborn.
Only if we were getting money for every time you've mentioned that name.
What's that? Final Fantasy XIV?
A Realm Reborn.
Yes.
I don't know why I have to shift into Batman voice to say
A Realm Reborn,
but I do seem to have to do that. It just kind of feels natural. Feels good to me.
I know. That would have been like an extra expense for the advertisement for the game. We could say, well, if you want Matt to add the Batman voice.
That's right. Yeah,
that'll be an extra $40.
Much like the, I think it was, is it Michael Mann? No, that can't be right. The guy who does Let's Get Ready to Rumble. You know, that guy charges $10,000 to say that and gets paid it. He gets paid $10,000 to say, let's get ready to roll. He's also trademarked it and copyrighted it as a performance. So nobody can do that but him and I think his brother.
Huh.
And I actually heard him in an interview one time. This is the man who defined a generation with, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the... You know, he does the whole nine thing. I don't want to get in trouble even just trying to say it, you know, because I don't have $10,000 to just, you know, say that line. So he gets out there and that's what he does, right? That's the big guy, you know, and he does boxing matches and what have you. And he got throat cancer. And so they had to do operation on him. And so, and they came back and they were interviewing him to talk about the hardships of throat cancer because, you know, hey, he makes a lot of money, but you take away your money and you take away your livelihood and what are you supposed to do? And how does that affect you? And how did you overcome? And so he starts answering the questions and he kind of talks like this when he's answering his questions. And it's an interesting way to look at your career. And I was like, whoa, is that the same dude? That is not the same guy. There's just, I mean, it looks like him, but no way is that guy. Because he sits down and he's very, very, very simple and he talks. And then he steps into the ring. And I was like, whoa, that is just crazy.
People might not know this, but Matt is actually 3 feet tall. He's a dwarf. And he has a lot of facial hair.
Yes. Neck beard.
Dad, yes.
That's my
Actually,
that's
I need
my
to
nickname.
Shave mine. Neck beard?
Not really.
You are the evil pirate, neck beard.
R, matey. I am rated R for booty. And there you go. But enough about me and the nonsensical ramblings of a guy who plays Final Fantasy XIV. A Realm Reborn. Can't do it with a straight face anymore. You want to just go ahead and get into the news?
Sure.
All right, let's do this then. The news! I only have some quick stuff, so I guess I'm just going to knock my crap out of the way. Sylvester Stallone! Yes, this comes to us from Yahoo Movies, courtesy of Joel Ryan at Movie Talk. Expendables 3, The 7 Ways Sylvester Stallone Gets His Men and Women. And I love the intro to this article. This is the first paragraph of the article. I love it. A media-branded pariah, an ex-con, a battered Indiana Jones. From Mel Gibson to Wesley Snipes to Harrison Ford, the just-announced cast for Sylvester Stallone's Expendables 3 is bold-faced enough, notorious enough, and eclectic enough to just make you ask, how does he do it anyway? It's really cool. The first thing, they basically say Sylvester Stallone is really actually pretty smart. He has a simple plan. He looks for down-on-their-luck stars. Okay? Quote, I like using people that had a moment and then maybe have fallen on some hard times and give them another shot. And that, end quote. That's what Stallone told Entertainment Weekly in 2011. So this is how he's grabbing people like Gibson, who ranted himself off the A-list, and Ford, who just detonated his biggest ever bomb with his little industrial spy thriller that just came out.
Paranoia,
yeah. And Stallone can technically even include himself on that list because Stallone once denounced an entire decade of his career. So that's kind of cool. Two, he looks for up-and-comers. So he tries to find young kids. That's how he got hold of a pre-Hunger Games Liam Hemsworth. A lot of people don't realize that even though Liam Hemsworth was in the second movie, he was actually in the first movie as well. It's just his part was small and got written out. And so they're like, look, you know, we're sorry we couldn't, you know, it didn't work out, but please come back. We've got a solid role that's, you know, integral to the plot of the story. So Liam came back, and that's how that thing got worked out. For Expendables 3, he's got Twilight alum Kellan Lutz, MMA fighter Ronda Rousey, who's apparently the lone woman in the cast, and boxer Victor Ortiz. He also, rule number three is he doesn't forget a former foe, which is why Dolph Lundgren came in. And that's how he's also getting Wesley Snipes, because if you remember back in Demolition Man. And then for the real-life version, that's why he went after Arnold Schwarzenegger, because they always were battling They were the action stars battling for top box office numbers. Number four says he doesn't forget, period. Says that Gibson has burned Bridger 3 in Hollywood, but he apparently made a good impression on Stallone, with whom he has not yet shared a screen. Quote, every time I met Mel, he's been a great guy, Stallone told Entertainment Tonight in 2010, at the height of the then-latest Gibson meltdown. Quote, he's done me a few favors, and I just like the fella. End quote. Number five, he works the phones. Lest you assume Stallone reaches out via the old Alexander Graham Bell, because the AARP-eligible actors on his wish list, from Snipes to Steven Seagal, who hasn't planned out, and who won't be in the upcoming movie, aren't wired in the same as millennials. Let it be known that Stallone also dials up younger folks like Hemsworth, who recalled after being cut from the early film, quote, he called a few days later, and it was weird speaking to him on my phone while I'm looking at his DVDs of Rocky and Rambo on the shelf, end quote. Six, he sets a price, just as Bruce Willis sets his. It's just that on The Expendables 3, the two prices, what Stallone's side was willing to pay and what Willis's was willing to take, didn't meet. And then, of course, Willis out, Harrison Ford in, great news, been waiting years for this. That's the tweet that Stallone sent. So he sticks to the money. And last but not least, number seven, he does not give up. Quote, I reach out and try, end quote. That is what Stallone said on a 2010 San Diego Comic-Con panel of his then unsuccessful efforts to land Jean-Claude Van Damme, Chuck Norris, and Steven Seagal. However, as we know, for the second one, he did land both Van Damme and Norris. And he does keep shooting for Seagal, but whatever. The last line of the quote, and this again is because he doesn't give up. Stallone told the UK's Telegraph in 2010, quote, you have to be irrationally passionate, end quote. So that is my Expendables 3 stuff. So if you ever wondered how the hell do all these people come into play, that's how they come into play. Next up,
it all makes sense.
It all makes sense now. Next up, a little bit of Star Wars news. Gilbert Taylor, Star Wars cinematographer, dies at age 99. And this was August 23rd, 2013. And he was a veteran British cinematographer and, of course, worked on Star Wars, most famously. However, he also worked on The Omen and Doctor Strangelove. And he died at 99. According to his wife, Dee, he died on Friday with his family at his bedside at his home on the Isle of Wight. Kind of sad. You always, I don't know, it's just one of those things. It's kind of like the last tethers to the golden age of cinema. And you don't like hearing these people going away. And, of course, time carries on, always has, always will. He is not just remembered for The Omen, Doctor Strangelove, and Star Wars. He also has credits including Ice Cold and Alex, the Beatles film A Hard Day's Night, Alfred Hitchcock's Frenzy. He also worked with Roman Polanski on such films as Repulsion and Cul-de-Sac, for which he received back-to-back BAFTA nominations in consecutive years. And according to his wife, Taylor turned down a Bond picture to work with Polanski, quote, because he thought Roman was a very interesting guy, end quote. This is not someone who is to be trifled with. This was, you know, he wasn't just the one shot that, oh, because he was related to Star Wars or everything. This is just a guy who really loved his work, who really did his homework, was an excellent cinematographer, and passed away. It was interesting because his wife, Dee, is a script supervisor. She's 23 years younger than him. And they actually met on the set of the 1963 Tony Hancock film, The Punch and Judy Man. And switching into another thing, I'm sure by now most people around the world, if you're not living under a rock, know that Ben Affleck was cast as Batman in the Man of Steel sequel, Superman vs. Batman. And even more interesting is he is now also working on the script. So he's getting more and more duties, it's not less. There have been petitions to get rid of him. And I thought it was kind of interesting. This comes from Den of Geek. .us, and David Crow wrote this. Basically, yes, Ben Affleck is Batman. After the roar of internet rage washes over you like a warm, wet, impotent blanket, stop for a moment and let that sink in. Ben Affleck is Batman, and the world did not end last night, despite what some of the more creative and enterprising snarkers have tweeted. The sun is shining, the birds chirping, and as resignation slowly drifts through the fan community, the thought that maybe, just maybe, Ben Affleck can pull off Batman spreads. And remember, folks, It is possible. While Affleck is not anybody's first choice, well, maybe Ben Affleck's first choice, I don't know, for the role, you have to remember that people have seen him give good supporting performances. And it's not just him carrying Batman versus Superman. He gets to work with Henry Cavill. Let's remember, Stranger Things have happened. And here's how we know. Because here are seven actors that fans thought would suck. Number seven, Jennifer Lawrence is Katniss Everdeen from The Hunger Games. Yeah. So remember, before Jennifer Lawrence went on to win fans' hearts at the U.S. box office with the $408 million, a feat that Iron Man 3 has only just now barely matched, and everyone else with her Oscar-winning turn in last fall's Silver Linings Playbook, she was the girl who couldn't catch fire. At least that's what a very vocal backlash in the fan community, as well as some decidedly harsh critics, had to say. And yet, all of a sudden, when it came out, amazing! She was awesome! Holy crap, you couldn't figure out a better person to do it. Number six, Daniel Craig as James Bond. Or as that one bloke called him, James Blonde. Yes, folks, he was the one that was cast as Bond back in 2005 when everyone wanted Pierce Brosnan to return. There was absolutely no way he could play Her Majesty's loyal terrier. Whatever happened to that guy? Well, let's face it. He's been the best damn Bond, arguably, since Sean Connery.
I can argue with that. He just only recently won me over with Skyfall.
Yeah, and then Skyfall. Ugh. But, of course, that one whole thing where they made him real, whatever. Number five on this list, and this one is pretty big for film fanatics, Audrey Hepburn as Holly Golightly from Breakfast at Tiffany's. Before the internet age, fan skepticism and outrage was kept to the quiet dignity of their own homes or ignored letters to the editor. However, sometimes these fans could find a famous champion to carry on their disdain at Hollywood developments. For example, it doesn't hurt when the author who created a character leads the charge. Look no further than when Truman Capote reacted in disbelief to the casting of Audrey Hepburn in her now most iconic role. Turns out that when Capote sold the rights to his short novella Breakfast at Tiffany's to Paramount Pictures, he did so with the express wish that Marilyn Monroe play the part of Holly Golightly, New York's ultimate good time girl. After all, Holly is supposed to be seductive, charismatic, and able to ensnare any man on her hook, if only ever fleetingly. But when Monroe passed on the part because Lee Strasberg advised Norma Jean that playing a prostitute would be bad for her image, the part went to the decidedly less bombshell Hepburn. When Capote saw that this thin, gamine waif was going to be his ultimate creation of superficial and jaded femininity, he remarked, quote, "Paramount double-crossed me in every way and cast Audrey," end quote. The article says, "Thank God." Could you imagine this movie with Marilyn Monroe?
No, I think it's perfect with Audrey Hepburn. She gives another idea of beauty that I think the 60s really needed. You know, with the brown hair, and she had the eyebrows, and just her style is completely different from Marilyn Monroe, which I thought worked perfectly for the whole storyline.
Number four on this list is Anne Hathaway as Catwoman, Dark Knight Rises. Everyone should recall this. Anne Hathaway cast as Selina Kyle, a.k.a. Catwoman. What? How? A Disney princess? It's interesting, though, because many of the loudest critics of her being cast as Catwoman never saw her in Brokeback Mountain or Rachel Getting Married, and they definitely never got to see the nudie sex scenes of Havoc, which, I mean, shoot, just go look up the scene. Forget watching the rest of the movie. Just look up the scenes. It's just everybody always tied Hathaway to The Princess Diaries. And yet it comes out and people are like, holy crap, look at that amazing body in that cat suit. And as far as I'm concerned, she can just wear the cat suit forever in every role. I mean, we don't have to have the little cat ear goggle things or whatever. That's fine. But yeah, she can just walk around in that outfit forever. I'm totally good with that. Number three, from the same franchise, not the same movie, Heath Ledger as the Joker. Everybody was up in arms over this one. If you think about it, pages of fans were looking for people like Christopher Walken, Crispin Glover, anybody else would have done. In 2006, nobody thought anyone, save Jack Nicholson, could be the Joker. I was not among them, because I understood that the tone of the series was different than what Tim Burton had done. I was just wondering how the character development of the Joker was going to be portrayed in this versus the way that Jack Nicholson did it back then. Number two, Vivian Leigh as Scarlett O'Hara, Gone with the Wind. The ultimate iconic Southern tale, uniquely American. And also goes to show that at the end of the day, just how gracious Americans really can be. Because Vivian Leigh's British, and that was the one thing that people were really pissed off about. Because they're like, hang on, you're putting a British chick to play Scarlett O'Hara? And then you watch Gone with the Wind and you're like, could anybody else have done that? This is just one of the best examples ever of amazing casting that people didn't like, but it worked out for the best. Number one on this list. This was an interesting choice for number one on this list. I was surprised to see this. Michael Keaton as Batman.
Yeah, that was a huge thing because Sylvester Stallone got pissed off because the whole action genre changed with Batman. That basically said that you didn't have to be a big, strong, tough guy to be a superhero, that a wimpy guy or a less built guy like Michael Keaton could just hide behind a bat suit with built-in six-pack abs.
And that is what the article points out as well. Number one, Michael Keaton as Batman, and of course Batman. Yes, the most obvious comparison is still the most fitting. Michael Keaton, America's official Mr. Mom, was cast by Tim Burton to play the Dark Knight. Keaton is not an assuming man. As a comedian with thin, receding hair and a height of 5 feet 9 inches, a muscular Uberman, he is not. Also, when he was cast in 1988, many could not get past this, that this was the guy from Night Shift and Beetlejuice. Were they remaking the campy Adam West TV show? The Wall Street Journal reported on the hundreds, some say tens of thousands, of protest letters they received over the casting. That is, until the first official promotional photo for Batman came out, which showed Michael Keaton in the Batman suit that was already, you know, that had all the ripped cuts that of muscle already placed in it and everything. And he's standing in front of the Batmobile in this iconic pose. And everybody shut up. Everyone's like, okay, you know what? Maybe we should give this a chance. And it was at that point the whining stopped. To this day, there is still a school of thought that prefers Keaton to all actors who have donned the cowl, even Christian Bale. Not bad for an actor who the Times once described as a prankster.
Alrighty, so my news. First off, Spike Lee wrapped up his little Kickstarter campaign. Oh my god. By wrapping up his Kickstarter campaign for his new, quote, newest, hottest Spike Lee joint, end quote. And according to CinemaBlend.com, his film reached its goal and earned the third highest amount of pledges for a film or TV series, raising over $1.4 million. But as it happens, the majority of that money didn't come from your friendly neighborhood Spike Lee fan, as the website Mars Investigations adequately lays out. Things already sounded fishy when it was revealed that Steven Soderbergh had donated $10,000. End quote. And this is coming after the whole Veronica Mars Kickstarter and the Zach Braff Kickstarter for his film Wish I Was Here. In less than a day, Veronica Mars got $2 million. That was its goal. And then Wish I Was Here got $2 million. And CinemaBlend also goes on to say that, quote, so the fact that it took Lee almost a month to get his $1.25 million already shows you that this project had nowhere near the amount of hype going for it. And then they go on to say that the average amount of money spent on Veronica Mars and Wish I Was Here per contributor was $62 to $66, but the average donation to Lee's film was $220. Astoundingly, 26.1% of Lee's money came from donors pledging $10,000 or more, while 42.8% came from unlisted backers, which is comprised of people who donated anonymously without the needs for rewards. And the people who donated more than $10,000 top donation. This anomaly is made even more strange when you realize that only 8.6% of Lee's donors were in the unlisted bracket. Combined with the 0.6% of 10,000 donors, you get an outrageous result, end quote. They have like a little pie chart on this website here on CinemaBlend, and they also mentioned that 9.2% of Lee's backers combined for 68.9% of the money earned. Meanwhile, those who donated between $1 to $99 made up the 79.6% majority of the pledgers, but were only responsible for 7.8% of the entire funding. And that was a lot of information right there. A lot of percentages and dollar signs and a lot of monies going around. Just a lot of rich people are funding Spike Lee's movie. And that kind of brings me to the question of, like, was this really... having a Kickstarter, is that really necessary for him? If he was just able to get a few people to... well, technically, it was a lot more than a few, but... hypothetically, a few people to really back his movie. Couldn't he just ask his friends for the money?
Here's what I think happened. I think that after the backlash of movie stars asking for money came into play, he couldn't take it down. So it had to be successful, and that's why they did it this way. So this way he could say, oh, my Kickstarter was a successful Kickstarter, so he doesn't look like he lost face to the media. Even though everybody now knows, look, you just got your friends to give you the money. For all we know, he could have just signed up for a whole bunch of accounts and paid it himself just to make it successful. And he really hasn't walked away with any money at all.
They say that he is worth like $40 million or something crazy like that. So I guess it's possible. All right, so my bit of Star Wars news is that Star Wars Episode 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 7, Episode 7, will be shot on 35mm film, as well as J.J. Abrams will be reuniting with the Star Trek cinematographer Dan Mindell, or Mindell. I guess it depends on how really you pronounce words. It could be Mindell or it could be Mindell, but I think Mindell is kind of an African-American name. I don't know. Whatever. It's kind of like Kevin. Other people's names are Kayvon. Mindell. I'll just go with Mindell. So yeah, so unlike George Lucas's prequel trilogy, that was all shot in digital. Or at least Episode 2 and Episode 3 were shot digitally. People thought that those movies were not aesthetically pleasing. So hopefully the 35mm, along with more practical effects, practical settings, mixed in with hopefully models and a little bit of CGI for the flavor and the icing on the cake, this movie and the movies that will come after this will be more aesthetically pleasing and more so relate to the original trilogy. So hopefully that will work. And I guess we will see in 2015 when these movies will be released.
Okay, here's my thing. I certainly get the idea behind it. And I totally agree with what's being said in the article and where they're coming from with that. However, the advances made in digital photography, I mean, we watched the documentary on it. With the advances that have been made in digital photography, and the fact that they've already said that they're going to be doing more maquettes, more real physical special effects, it's not just going to be CGI, I don't necessarily see the problem with shooting in digital.
Well, it could also go along with what you were saying last week about distancing themselves away from George Lucas and the George Lucas prequels with the release date. This could be another thing, just saying, well, hey, George Lucas nearly ruined a franchise by shooting this in digital, completely digitally. Therefore, now to set ourselves away from that, let's just go ahead and do it in 35mm. To where I think movies look better in 35mm. Kind of like how I think color looks better in Technicolor of the 1950s and the 1960s. I think colors are more vibrant with Technicolor. With a lot of people that watch film, also people that listen to music, people think that, you know, listening to vinyl sounds a lot better than listening to a CD because of compression of the files and the compression of the media itself. And I'm not sure exactly, but I'm willing to bet that doing a film digitally, it compresses the quality to where the quality is still really good and is crystal clear. However, it doesn't have that, you know, the one word that I like to say is gestalt. It doesn't have the gestalt in the frame. It doesn't have the aestheticness to it. I mean, a lot of people, they look at maybe the movie Oblivion or even the original or the original prequel. You know, look at Episode 2 and Episode 3. And people can argue that those movies looked way too polished. They looked way too clean. And I think with 35mm, it gives it another quality. It gives the movie another look to where there's more character to it. It doesn't look that much polished and doesn't look that completely clean. I'm looking forward to it. I think that's definitely a good use of something practical that will have a positive contribution to the movie.
Okay, well, hey, you know what? As you said, we will find out in 2015.
Also from Cinema Blend, again, Hollywood studios resolve the fight with China. It sounds like that the Hollywood studios are getting their tax money for doing all these movies set in China and using all these Chinese characters like Pacific Rim, Iron Man 3, and this is via LA Times, where the LA Times reports that the Motion Picture Association of America has settled a glaring tax dispute. And the Motion Picture Association, this is quoting LA Times, they say that, quote, "We are pleased to hear that the Chinese government has addressed the matter, and all money due will be paid in full," MPAA Chairman Chris Dodd said in a statement. "It is our understanding that the payment process has recommenced," end quote. So, for all of you guys that do care about this, great! For all of you guys that don't give a shit about this, moving on. Now my last piece of news, and this is from Cinema Blend. Last time I'm going to mention Cinema Blend, I promise. The headline of this article is, "Kentucky theater owner bans Lee Daniels, the butler, because of Jane Fonda." And Jane Fonda has a bit part in the movie playing Nancy Reagan, the wife of President Ronald Reagan. And this is all because that during the Vietnam War, quote, "Fonda was an outspoken anti-war protester, and her actions were conspired by some to be downright treasonous." According to CinemaBlend.com, they say that the Hollywood Reporter has drawn our attention to the News Enterprise interview with Ike Boutwell, owner of Movie Palace and Showtime Cinemas in Elizabethtown, Kentucky, and proud Marine Corps veteran. "It's been 38 years since the Vietnam War ended, but some wounds are slow to heal." And they go on to say that during the Vietnam War, Fonda was an outspoken anti-war protester, and her actions were considered by some to be downright treasonous. "I trained hundreds of pilots to fly, many of whom Miss Fonda clapped and cheered as they were shot down," Boutwell says in the interview. "Our Constitution only mentions three crimes. Treason is one. That's aid and comfort to the enemy. In the 1970s, Fonda visited the North Vietnam forces, which drew much ire from stateside soldiers and earned her the nickname Hanoi Jane. Over the past 30 years, he's run them. Boutwell has never, to his knowledge, shown one of Fonda's movies in his theaters. But her role as First Lady Nancy Reagan in Lee Daniels' The Butler has him especially aggrieved. "I just really think it's a slap in the face to have a person of treason portray a patriotic lady, Miss Reagan," he told the paper. "I just think it's throwing gas on the fire. This Marine Corps veteran isn't the only one boycotting the film because of Fonda. Across the nation, U.S. military veterans have made public their decision to avoid Lee Daniels, the butler, because of her role in it. A Facebook group called Boycott Hanoi Jane, playing Nancy Reagan, currently has over 31,000 members, but Fonda doesn't care. When she was asked about the response her casting created, she told The Hollywood Reporter, quote, "Get a life. The Facebook group creates hoopla. It will cause more people to see the movie. I figured it would tweak the right. Who cares?" End quote. Basically, my two cents on this is that back in the 60s, during Vietnam, she was a product of the hippie revolution, the anti-war protesting. You know, she was just caught up in that movement. She felt that her side was with the Viet Cong, and a lot of people did, a lot of the hippies did. And unfortunately, with her doing that, with her trying to show that the Viet Cong are people too, and that the war should stop, she stupidly posed in a famous picture of her in a, I guess it was a anti-aerial gun that has been used to shoot down numerous American planes. She's sitting there posing as if she's shooting down a plane. Times have changed. And she also apologized last year for doing it.
So good, then we're done. The news is complete. We are ready to move on to the return of Three Squares. Squared.
Our Three Squared for this week is our three favorite directors who have made appearances in other directors' films. And the example that I gave was George Lucas making an appearance in Beverly Hills Cop Part 3, where he plays a theme park attendee waiting to go on a ride. Eddie Murphy cuts in front of him, gets on the ride, and George Lucas has like a little bitty line, and that's it. But he's kind of known for being in that movie, so we were supposed to pick our three favorite appearances of directors in other directors' flicks. So I know Matt has a Steven Spielberg choice for his. I have one as well, and I have two. So my first director is Steven Spielberg. He made an appearance in 1984's Gremlins, the Joe Dante flick about the Gremlins. You know, it's a Gremlins. Who doesn't know the story of Gremlins? If you don't, then you gotta check it out immediately. He's the man in the wheelchair. And also his other appearance is from 2002's Goldmember, the Tom Shadyac, Austin Powers, Mike Myers movie, where he plays himself in probably one of the funniest openings to a comedy or a spoof I've ever seen, where Steven Spielberg is directing an Austin Powers movie called Austin Pussy, where Tom Cruise is Austin Powers, Kevin Spacey as Dr. Evil, and John Travolta as Goldmember. You know, they say cut on the movie, and it turns out is, you know, it's Steven Spielberg.
You better watch your friggin' self, because this is one doctor who does make house calls. Right, Mini-Me?
Hey, assholes! I'm right over here! I'm Mini-Me! Come and get me!
And cut!
Everybody.
So, Austin, what'd you think of the opening credits?
Well, I can't believe Sir Steven Spielberg, the grooviest filmmaker in the history of cinema, is making a movie about my life. Very shagadelic, baby. Yeah. Having said that, I do have some thoughts.
Really? My friend here thinks it's fine the way it is.
Well, no offense, Sir Stevie, but you gotta have mojo, baby. Yeah! Hit it!
And it's just very funny. It's just something that just completely catches you off guard. And even for those who probably did not like the movie as a whole, I think a lot of people really got a kick out of seeing Steven Spielberg being Steven Spielberg and kind of playing a joke on himself. Now, my next director is Michael Bay. He was in Kinka Usher's Mystery Men. You know, that superhero movie with Ben Stiller, William H. Macy, Hank Azaria, Jeffrey Rush as Casanova Frankenstein. One of my favorite villains of any superhero movie is actually Casanova Frankenstein. But Michael Bay has a small role. He plays the leader of a frat gang. Basically, these are like college frat guys from, it looks like, the 1950s and the 1960s. And that's kind of like their gang. That's their gang theme, I guess. And there's this one scene when they're trying to figure out what they're going to do about killing or getting rid of Captain Amazing, which is what the main superhero that Greg Kinnear plays, that is like the Superman of the city.
What about Captain Amazing?
That is an excellent question, Big Tobacco. What are we going to do about the greatest superheroes that Champion City has ever known, For the answer, I want you all to walk this way.
Dude, can we bring the brewskis?
Yes, of course, you may absolutely bring the brewskis. Yeah!
And Michael Bay just says, well, dude, can we bring our brewskis with us? And that's the one, that is his claim to acting fame. His first appearance in Mystery Men. And again, at the time when it first came out, I didn't really catch on to it. But it was probably in the early to mid 2000s when I was like, holy shit, I think that's Michael Bay. And I went on to IMDb and I was like, holy shit, that is Michael Bay. And I was like, holy shit, Michael Bay is in a movie and he's actually acting. So it was kind of nice to see that. Now my third and final pick, or my third and final director, is David Cronenberg. And David Cronenberg has made appearances in quite a few movies. However, he makes an appearance, and it's actually kind of a larger role than just an appearance. He actually plays a character, but it's a really good movie about the end of the world. It's like the last day before the world ends, and it's supposed to be the turn of the millennium, 2000, and something is supposed to happen, and everybody's supposed to die. And the pick is called Last Night, and it's from 1988. It was directed by Don McKellar. It was a Canadian movie. And all I can really think of was that the reason why David Cronenberg did the movie is because the movie was shot in Canada. Don McKellar is a Canadian himself, and I think they were friends. I know Michael Bay and Kinka Usher, was known for doing music videos and I think commercials, and that's how he knows Michael Bay, and that's why Michael Bay was in Mystery Men. I think that was kind of the same thing with Last Night. David Cronenberg knew Don McKellar, and that is how he took on the role. In his role in the movie, he's kind of like the CEO of a gas company.
So, juice.
Oh, perfect.
Tropical punch.
You treat me so well.
Well, you get one every day at around now, if I'm not mistaken. I thought I'd try it myself.
I thought you never noticed.
No. But I did. So, how goes the battle?
Fine. Good. Good old computer.
Well, imagine, even 10 years ago, you'd have had to have 8 or 9 stations just to keep the system running.
I know.
And now?
Now.
Just you.
And you.
Oh, and I. I'm almost done.
So, then again, those are my favorite directors making an appearance in other directors' flicks. And again, they were Steven Spielberg in Joe Dante's Gremlins, as well as Tom Shadyac's Goldmember, Michael Bay in Kinka Usher's Mystery Men, and then finally, David Cronenberg in Don McKellar's Last Night from 1998.
Awesome, awesome, awesome. Okay. My three picks, I'm going to have to do, yes, that just as Tim said, I'm starting off with Steven Spielberg. All right, so this was kind of interesting. My first two were kind of like a buddy swap. All right, so Steven Spielberg and Cameron Crowe know each other, of course, through the history of Hollywood movie making and stuff. They've run into each other. And they kind of struck up a little, hey, wouldn't it be cool if you got into one of my movies things? And Steven Spielberg said, okay, sure. So Cameron Crowe goes and does Vanilla Sky, which is the one with Tom Cruise and Penelope Elf Cruz and Cameron Diaz. And there's a scene in the movie where Steven Spielberg walks up as himself to Tom Cruise because, well, if you haven't seen it by now, too bad. The movie is pretty much more or less happening in Tom Cruise's head. And Steven Spielberg walks up and he says, you lucky son of a bitch, to Tom Cruise's character, and goes on whatever. As a payback for that, Steven Spielberg was doing Minority Report, also with Tom Cruise. So they decided Cameron Crowe should come in for that one. So Cameron Crowe has a blink and you'll miss it thing. He's with Tom Cruise, I believe it was at the beginning of the movie, where they are the future police, because you thought about committing a crime in the future, so they come and get you now before you can commit it. Cameron Crowe is one of the SWAT team members there at the beginning. So if you're not paying attention, you're not going to realize it's him, but there you go. So those are my two of my three movies for the three squared. So Steven Spielberg and Cameron Crowe's Vanilla Sky, and then Cameron Crowe and Steven Spielberg's Minority Report. And I just think it's kind of interesting because they both starred Tom Cruise. That's kind of the pivotal thing there. But the reason why I just kind of dismissively use those, because they're cool. I think it's kind of cool that directors do that kind of stuff. And both movies, Vanilla Sky was interesting. I liked it. Minority Report was pretty good. But I really just kind of like the dynamic of that. The reason why is because this one, my number one pick, is completely ridiculously chock full. John Landis' Spies Like Us. This is the 1986 buddy comedy featuring Chevy Chase and Dan Aykroyd, where they come from completely disparate lives and come together to try and become spies. And mainly through the machinations of Chevy Chase, Dan Aykroyd gets thrown under the bus. But they end up working together to save the world. And this is a movie where John Landis landed everybody. Okay, he got Frank Oz, and this was not the first time that Frank Oz had worked with John Landis, but he gets Frank Oz to make an appearance. He gets Terry Gilliam of Brazil and Monty Python. He gets Martin Brest, Beverly Hills Cop. He gets Costa Gavras from the movie Z, Michael Apted from the Up films, and as security guards, Sam Raimi and Joel Coen, half of the Coen brothers.
Drive-in is closed.
We're with the Ace Tomato Company.
And so there you go. That is just completely amazing that he was able to get all these people in there. And this movie, for me, is completely ridiculous and totally funny and one of the great 80s comedies. And it is amongst my collection on the bookcases here. It's not even a bookcase anymore. It's just DVD cases. Wall of DVDs and Blu-rays. And that's what I have. So my three squared real easy again. Steven Spielberg and Cameron Crowe's Vanilla Sky. Cameron Crowe and Steven Spielberg's Minority Report. And everybody in John Landis's Spies Like Us. Then there's nothing left but the movie. Yes, the movie's all right. We had The World's End, Melancholia, and Iron Sky.
Yeah, three end-of-the-world movies.
Yeah. Well, kind of. Well, okay, definitely two out of the three. I'm not sure Iron Sky counts as an apocalyptic
movie. Mass destruction.
Movie. It is a mass destruction movie. But yeah. What do you want to start off with?
Let's start off with Iron Sky.
Ladies and gentlemen, the day we have been expecting is fast drawing near. Whilst we have been going about our respectable lives, those with sick and depraved minds have been building their armies and constructing their story. A preposterous story that will attempt to redefine history and dazzle the world with mind-blowing special effects.
What is this device?
Oh, that's my kick-ass computer.
That is not a computer.
Sis is a computer.
I think you know what I'm talking about, ladies and gentlemen. That's right. Motherfucking space Nazis in a film called Iron Sky.
Iron Sky. Okay. So Iron Sky is kind of a weird movie, and as such, Tim is the one who found it. Look at me. Look at me driving the bus right now. Ah, there's Tim. Tim is now going to do the rest of the show from under the bus. It is a 2012 Finnish, German, Australian comic science fiction action film. It's directed by Timo Vuorensola, and it's written by Johanna Sinisalalo and Michael Kalinsko. I don't know, man. Kalisniko. You figure this stuff out. Look it up on Wikipedia, folks.
I think everything that you just said there is something that I've eaten recently that I've ordered off a menu.
I'll take
the Johanna salad.
Exactly. Sandwich. Can I get the taro kakakuma'a? Blended drink? Yes. So this is a movie about imagining that Germany never actually lost World War II. They merely saw the end coming and decided to regroup on the dark side of the moon, where they're basically going to build the master race from there and then come back and take over the world.
Which you think they would have like a better name for the dark side of the moon after all those years of being on the dark side of the moon? Instead of just calling it the dark side of the moon?
Yeah, I don't know. They referred to it as the Fourth Reich, I guess. I mean, there's that, I suppose. They are then discovered by accident by the American... And, of course, they're in a time... They're kind of locked in a time warp because while they were somehow smart enough to get to the moon, they and build... somewhat advanced machinery. It's all based on 1945 technology, and there's been no advances in said technology, nor any advances in radio technology, so that they have no idea that any time has passed on Earth. So when they're discovered by accident by a supermodel astronaut whose sole purpose for going to the moon is because a Sarah Palin-esque, again, with this movie is 2012, which is what gets me, but they're treating it like it's 2010 or something because they're making fun of Sarah Palin, imagining that she became president. And her idea was to send a black man to the moon. So it's completely ridiculous. I don't know, man. This movie is just bad. There is one scene that gave me so much hope for this movie. There is a movie, I have seen it on, I believe it's on Netflix. It's called Downfall. And it is basically the last few days / week of Hitler's life in the bunker in Berlin. There is a pivotal scene in this movie where Hitler completely loses it. And it has been hijacked by the internet, and they, because it's all in German, they changed the subtitles to completely talk about anything else that they want to talk about. So it becomes more about guilds and WoW mad at each other, and they're trying to strategize against each other, or people, someone who's mad. Basically, when some person who's the head of an organization is mad about anything, they just change the subtitles and make it absolutely hilarious. There's a scene in this movie, and they basically almost verbatim copy the scene from Downfall. And it starts with the president of the United States, I guess, a campaign manager, strategist, publicity person. And she's in her office in Times Square, and there's a whole bunch of people around her, and she's looking over this stuff on her desk, and she just gets all, you know, she's got this frustrated look on her face. And then they do this pan to the side, and she reaches up with a trembling hand and pulls her glasses off of her face and then shakes as she sets them down on the desk. And I'm like, oh, are they going to do it? Are they going to do the scene? And she does. And they get almost everything from the cutouts into the hall to somebody crying in the hall. They do all this stuff. So catch that scene on YouTube if you ever want to watch this movie so that you can totally understand that. It was a great thing. It was probably the funniest thing in the movie that I saw. Pretty much everything else in this movie is it's just not good. I get that it's trying to be campy. I get that it's trying to be funny. I certainly understand that this is not American humor, but at the same time, you kind of get the feeling that we're the butt of a lot of more jokes in the rest of the world than we think we are, because we kind of are. And while I understood the jokes, they just weren't funny.
There was a lot of jokes that probably were funny in like 1995. That they used, especially with the American astronaut guy. Just a lot of the stuff he said and like his reactions to things really were pretty hammy.
I know, and the thing is that it's 2012, so I don't understand why the jokes are. I don't know. I guess this is one of those things where being the butt of the stereotype, you don't get it. Maybe that's just how they perpetually think of us, and that's fine. I mean, stereotypes exist for a reason. Stereotypes are there because they're true. But these are somewhat dated stereotypes, and so it doesn't make it a lot of fun to watch. Not because you don't want to be in on the joke, and not because you should be offended. I mean, I was not. There was nothing offensive here. It's just, it's tired. All the jokes in here are tired, and the movie's not very good. And it's interesting because I don't know that it definitely didn't do well here. This is kind of a direct-to-DVD thing for us. I think there was probably a brief release here. I don't know, maybe it did well over there. But I mean, it's basically the Nazis strike back. All for naught, really.
With bitchin' effects, though. They had some awesome special effects for this movie, which I was not expecting whatsoever. Like, I was kind of blown away by the detail of, like, the ships.
I'm sorry, I was not. I will admit that they were better than what I was expecting for this caliber of a movie, but I would not say that they were, like, amazing or anything. I would say that, if anything, they'll at least keep you watching because they're not totally stupid. However, I believe it's Julia Dietz. If I'm saying that right, I hope I'm saying that right. I believe she is the star of the movie. She's Renata Richter, and dude, she's hot. I don't care how bad this movie is. She's hot. I could probably watch another terrible movie if she was in it. And she's in it a lot. So, yeah. That's all. I mean, I don't know. For me, 1.5 stars. It was mildly interesting to kind of see the campiness of this movie and what they attempted to do. It's just not a good movie. It's just not. 1.5 stars. I didn't hate it. It's right in the middle. It was, instead of it being right in the middle between, it's not okay, like a 2.5 star movie, but I didn't quite hate it I didn't like it. And I did not like it. It was worse than not like, but I didn't hate it. So I'm going to give it a star and a half. If, you know, morbid curiosity brings you to check this movie out, then there you go.
So you liked Kick-Ass 2 more so than Iron Sky?
Yes.
Oh.
Yes. And not much more. Come on now, not much more. Kick-Ass 2, wasn't that 2 stars?
Yeah, for you, yeah.
Okay.
I think.
So come on, Kick-Ass 2 is just a little bit better than this one. I'm not saying that don't make it sound like I gave Kick-Ass 2 5 stars and I'm we're talking about a half star here.
True.
Yeah.
Well, a little bit of background on Iron Sky, I just feel like I should mention, is that Iron Sky was one of a slew of the new wave of movies that was being produced in collaboration with an online community of filmmakers. So the film got collaborators via this, I guess it's a website called wreckamovie.com, which is a collaborative filmmaking website where you can find people that will donate money, will donate ideas, story ideas, bits and pieces of a script, will donate their special effects talents, you know, what they can do on a computer, just anything that involves work on a movie. This website, you can go on there and you can exploit your talents, you know, in hopes that people like it and they want you to work on their project. The producers invited everyone to contribute ideas and resources to the project, which I think is really cool. Now, what I thought about the movie is that I thought it had great special effects. Though the movie doesn't completely work with the humor, with some of the acting, with the symbolism especially, but parts were well made. I mean, there were things that were well done. How the action was executed, how some of the suspense, and surprisingly there is suspense, and how the music was used, and how the characters were used, how the villains became the villains in the movies, how the heroes became the heroes in the movies, in the movie, was just very entertaining for me to watch. And I was convinced, mostly I was convinced, that I was actually watching a good movie. Not for the entire movie, but there was just, you know, there were moments, often there were moments that I was convinced that I was watching a good movie, which I thought, that surprised me completely. I thought that this movie made strides to legitimately please the audience, that I could tell that they were really wanting to make a good movie. They were wanting to make a crowd pleaser. And overall, I think they succeeded. And lastly, I think this movie really worked for me. And I didn't absolutely love the movie, but I enjoyed it for what it was. The reason why it worked is because since it's years and years and years after World War II, they didn't make it like futuristic Nazis. Like, these were Nazis with lasers. These were Nazis with Lugers, with pistols, wearing the SS officer uniforms from World War II. Like Matt was saying, that they didn't age, so they stayed in the non-progressive 40s attire, in the 40s affair that was best represented by the 1940s Nazis. And to me, that made the movie work. That they're not futuristic, they're not using laser guns or anything like that. So the believability aspect of it fit in with the whole sci-fi aspect. The movie, to me, was more practical. So because of Netflix not allowing half stars, I gave the movie 3 out of 5 stars. I enjoyed it. Like I said, I felt that at times, most of the time, this was a movie that was trying to be a good movie, and in doing so, I thought it succeeded. So again, Iron Sky, for me, was a 3 out of 5 star flick. Okay, well, next up we have Melancholia, the 2011 Lars von Trier film, his follow-up to Antichrist. And he's actually the one that's making the new Nymphomaniac movie that's coming out that we've been covering in depth as much as we can, because we know Matt over here is really looking forward to seeing it. But we're not talking about Nymphomaniac now. So let's check out a little bit of Melancholia before we discuss it.
Won't even bother saying how late you are.
So sorry, guys.
We're only there. Mm-hmm. That was 2 hours ago.
Toast to the bride and the groom. Justine and Mike.
You look glowing today. Never seen you look so happy.
I'm thrilled about this wedding, and I know it's costing John a lot of money.
It's not about the cost. I thought you really wanted this.
But I do. What star is that? The red one.
I don't know.
What's going impossible, Justine. It's a planet that has been hiding behind the sun. Now it passes by us.
I just have one thing to say. Enjoy it while it lasts. I myself hate marriages.
Can we please? Is everyone in your family Stark raving mad?
I smile and I smile and smile.
You're lying to all of us.
I'm not really happy.
This could have been a lot different.
Yes, Michael, that could have been.
Just forget it. Stop dreaming, Justine.
What are we excited about?
Tomorrow night.
That's right.
I'm afraid of that stupid thing.
And it is not going to hit us.
You promise? Life is only on Earth. And not for long. I don't think you know that at all. Sometimes I hate you so much. Help me, Justin. I want to do this the right way.
I'm afraid that the planet will hit us anyway.
Alrighty, so like I said before, Melancholia is the 2011 Lars von Trier film, and as you can probably tell by the tone of the trailer, that this is not your regular run-of-the-mill disaster flick. Instead, it's a more realistic domestic drama set during an impending doom. You have this planet called Melancholia, which is on a collision course with Earth, and the audience already knows that Earth will be destroyed because of the opening scenes of the movie, which kind of act as the film's overture. For example, you know, in the trailer, if you've seen it, which I'm sure a lot of people have seen it, at least whenever the movie originally came out, where everything's in slow motion and the little electrodes and the magnetic energy is coming out of Kirsten Dunst's fingertips, and she's in the water and she's moonbathing naked on the golf course, and just all this really pretty visual, slow-motion-y stuff to look at. Well, that's pretty much a part of the movie's overture, with the astounding Wagner operatic music as the film's scoring and underscoring playing. And so you already know that the film is going to be destroyed within the first 10 minutes of the movie. So there is no doubt in anybody's mind that there is any sign of hope. And the reason why Lars von Trier did this, because he didn't want people anticipating or focusing on the disaster itself, like when it was going to happen. Von Trier had no ambitions to portray the science of things realistically whatsoever, but instead he wanted to use this impending event as a way to examine the human psyche during a disaster. So he took the end of the world disaster and he wanted to focus on what thoughts were running through people's minds. How does a person react to the thought of not only are they going to die, but their loved ones are going to die? Everyone that they know is going to die. The entire world itself will be destroyed. This is a disaster film without the cliches. Instead, the cliches are substituted with the side effects of the thoughts of impending doom on the human psyche. Like I said before, the idea of knowing that you're going to die, your friends are going to die, your family is going to die, and everybody else is going to die. This movie focuses on that thought. And for those of you that don't know this, according to Merriam-Webster.com, the actual definition of melancholia is a mental condition, and especially a manic depressive condition, characterized by extreme depression, bodily complaints, and often hallucinations and delusions. And this is basically the character of Justine. Kirsten Dunst's character. This is her. This movie takes place in two parts. Part one is called Justine. Part two is entitled Claire. Justine is the bride. At the beginning of the movie, she's late to her wedding party. However, there is just something on her mind. She's in this state of depression. This state of melancholia, sadness, I guess, to where she feels that something about her, where it feels like the things that make up her are completely falling apart. And a lot of this is because of the planet itself that is coming into the Earth's atmosphere, how it's reacting with the electro fields up in space. I apologize, scientists out there, I'm probably not saying the correct wordage for any of this sciencey stuff, so I apologize. And that's having a direct impact on these characters, how they act, how they react with one another. So therefore, this wedding, this whole entire wedding scene during the first half of the movie is just kind of sad to watch, because these people are reacting in ways that they probably aren't reacting before. And actually, this is one of the things that I liked about the movie. I really liked how each of the characters were affected in some way by this impending doom. This state of mind that these characters are put in takes a drastic toll on each and every one of them. For example, you have Alexander Skarsgård's character of Michael, who plays Kirsten Dunst's boss, and they're like in advertising or something, and he's trying to get from her this tagline from this piece of advertisement, from this picture or anything. He just wants this tagline to really sell the image. And out of all nights, for him to try to get this out of her, get this tagline out of her, he does it on her wedding night. And basically, just one thing after another happens, with her mother being a belligerent divorcee. Her father, who is actually a pretty nice guy, starts flirting with these younger girls that are, I believe, that are part of the wedding party. So you just have all these people acting out of character. You have Charlotte Gainsborough, who plays Claire, Kirsten Dunst's sister. She's getting all anal retentive about the party, worried that it's not going well, and she's worried that people aren't having a good time. Her husband, which Kiefer Sutherland plays, his name is John, Claire's husband. He's the one that funded the entire wedding, so he has bukus of cashola, and he's just kind of being a rich asshole. However, he, it turns out, is kind of a scientist, and he is obsessed with this whole impending doom phenomenon that is going on. The idea for this film came about when Lars von Trier was in therapy for depression. And during his treatments, his therapist had told him that depressive people tend to act a little bit more calmly than other people during heavy pressure situations, because apparently they already expect bad things to happen. And so that's kind of why von Trier developed this story, not primarily as a disaster film, but as a look into a character's psyche. And that's why I like this movie. It takes the tension of what's going to happen during a disaster, and he focuses it on the characters themselves. You have pretty things to look at. You have beautiful music, but when it comes down to it, this movie is about the characters and how these actors portray these characters. And boy, do they do a good job. How Kirsten Dunst portrays her character as this depressed woman going through all these stages, and then by the end of the movie, I don't want to spoil it or anything, just accepts death. And then going back and finding out that the director himself went in and did research. He experienced some of this stuff, so therefore he was able to take real-life experience, research on the side, and create these well-rounded characters. And the movie just works. And I apologize, I'm sure this review is kind of going back and forth, but it's really hard to effectively review a movie that kind of has some sort of personal effect on you. This movie kind of reminds me of The Tree of Life from the same year, 2011. Where after that movie, it had such an effect on me, and it reminded me of my relationship growing up with my father and how him and I used to butt heads. And it wasn't until I got older when I realized, well, you know, it's my father's house. I should listen to him. My dad was not a bad guy. I wasn't a bad kid. It was just father-son stuff. And so after the movie, I had to give my father a call and tell him I love him. That is how much of an impact that movie had on me. Now, I can't go as far as to saying that Melancholia did that same thing to me, and it was, you know, had that same level of emotional effect on me, but it was still a good movie. It still moved me. I could still understand what the characters were going through. I've had spouts of sadness. A lot of us have had spouts of sadness. I've had family members that suffered depression. I've had friends that suffered depression. I've sat with them, I talked to them, I listened to everything that they were going through, and I gotta say that, to me, I thought this movie hit the nail on the head. Now, granted, these are people put in a disastrous situations, but with my friends and family members, they were put in personal disastrous situations, like losing a loved one, losing a spouse, losing a child, losing a sibling, losing their house, losing all of their personal possessions. And then seeing them going through all that torment, all that emotional torment, and then watching this movie, they just did it right. This is one of those experience movies where you watch the movie for the experience. This movie might have some kind of emotional impact on you while watching it. It might not. It just depends if this is one of those movies you like to watch. This movie is about 2 hours and 15 minutes. And like Tree of Life, there's a lot of music in it. The characters only speak in short bursts. No long monologues, not a lot of witty banter or anything. So you just have to be in that frame of mind. And either you like these movies, or you don't like these movies. But I implore you, if you even have a little bit of a curiosity of seeing this movie, I think you should definitely check it out. If you don't like it, then you just spent 2 hours and 15 minutes looking at interesting lighting. So this movie is definitely worth checking out for that immersive experience. And if you buy it, you buy it. If you don't, well, you don't. So I give it 4 out of 5 stars. I didn't absolutely love the movie, but I enjoy it for what it is and what it had to offer.
Okie dokie. I completely disagree with everything that you have said. Let's start off with no cliches. This whole fucking movie is a cliche. Everything, every character in it is a cliche. And what's worse,
I was talking about the disaster. You gotta let me cliches. Get it out here. I was talking about the disaster cliches.
No, but everything in this movie, everything about this movie, including the disaster and the impending disaster or the supposed disaster, depending upon how you want to view the characters' outlooks in the movie as it goes forward. And I'm looking at Kiefer Sutherland's character specifically, okay, as John, Claire's husband here. Everything, they're all walking cliches, all of them, okay? You've got this dutiful yet miserable sister, long-suffering sister who never really sticks up for herself or tries to do anything serious to help her sister, Kirsten Dunst. You have this chick who you are never truly given any reason for her depression, just that she is. And it's alluded to lightly that it might be hereditary because of the way that her mother behaves in the beginning of the movie. However, she's got a complete family around, and of course Melancholia is not just the name of the planet, but is actually the original name of the condition. If you look at Edgar Allan Poe, they believe in today's world we would diagnose that more than likely as clinical depression, but then it was known as melancholia, where it's just periods, sometimes brief, sometimes long-term, where you're just in complete and utter despair no matter what. And that's fine, but everything about this movie is cliched. The disaster itself is cliched. The way the people play out is cliched. The beginning of the movie is cliched, because all of it forces you to attempt to feel something that if you don't, then you've wasted your time. And they're wasting their time by trying to make you feel this way artificially. And it starts at the beginning of the movie with 7 minutes and 18 seconds of nothing but music and slow motion photography with some weird special effects. I will, however, say the music is fantastic. And just as a point of reference, 12:41 a.m. on August 23rd, I sent Tim a text message. Okay, which would be 10:41 p.m. for him, August 22nd, because, as you know, he's in California, I'm in Texas. So I'm 6 minutes into Melancholia, and I already hate it. The music is nice. I guess that's something. I remember watching the trailer for this movie before it came out and thinking that the only reason to watch it would be to see Kirsten Dunst's boobs, but you get to see those in the trailer, so LOL. Yeah. To which Tim replied, haha, 2 hours of pretty stuff to look at. The only good thing about this is it's not even just boobs. You do get to see her boobs, which are an amazing set, by the way. You get to see her, maybe a 60 degree angle, with the frontal action going on, and she's totally nude. So that was kind of cool. Moonlight bathing her by the creek and everything. So that's all wonderful and well and good. That's probably the highlight of the whole movie, actually. That is the highlight of the whole movie, aside from the end, where thankfully everybody dies. This is a movie that does so much to try and be art house and be so in your face art house that is where it fails. It sits there and tries to be pretty, and it tries to be smart, and it tries to show you all these wonderful things and these complex characters, but everything is just dumb. The whole beginning of the movie, where they're trying to set up the relationship between the sisters, fails everywhere. You've got this boss played by Alexander Skarsgård, who I really like as an actor, and he plays a complete jerk at the wedding. Kirsten Dunst's character is shifting focus. She's trying to put on a brave face, but she's in a state of melancholia. It doesn't matter that it's her wedding. So she's acting all weird. She throws her wedding away, and the groom doesn't even seem to give a flying fuck. So you're already asking yourself, why the fuck is anybody even going through with this shit? Her mom's a bitch. Her dad loves her, but he's a philanderer. And nobody seems to give a shit about anybody. Everyone is simply in it for themselves. And honestly, the best person who exemplifies that is Udo Kier. He's the guy who plays the wedding planner. Also was the Fuhrer in Iron Sky. So, you know, you get to see him twice in a week if you're watching all these movies. Everybody's just in this thing for themselves. Everybody. Everybody has, it's all about them, it's all about what they want, it's all about what they get, and it doesn't fucking matter if people are depressed, or if people are looking at it from a certain perspective. And as someone who has dealt with, not me personally having clinical depression, but my immediate family having to deal with that, this movie does not exemplify that. This movie is more about, look how artsy-fartsy and pretty we are. Look at how good we think we are about putting together a movie that's supposed to be so serious and supposed to be... In the meanwhile, it's really just about a whole bunch of selfish-ass people who are stupid and don't understand each other, don't try to understand each other, don't want to work things out, and pull it off in a completely cliched wrapper of crap that is then 2 hours and 15 minutes long. It's not a good movie. It's too much in your face, and there are people who are going to be, but it's so beautiful, but don't look at the cinematography, and look at the way that the framing is done, and look at the complexity between the relationships, and yet you have only so much time to set this up, and the whole movie takes place, strictly speaking, what you physically see takes place, the first half of the movie takes place in about 4, 5, 6, 7 hours, and then the second one takes place are led to believe is probably about a week or so, and there's a gap in between that is undefined. There's a reason why this movie, there are valid reasons why this movie is not good. And you are now getting both sides. You are literally getting both ends of the spectrum. The score gives it 1 star. This is a 1-star movie. I hated this movie. I'm so glad I don't have to watch this movie ever again. So, last but not least, good Lord, get us the fuck out of this movie. The World's End, the Edgar Wright directed movie, written by Edgar Wright and Simon Pegg, starring Simon Pegg, Nick Frost, Patty Considine, Martin Freeman, Eddie Marsan, and Rosamund Pike. This is the closing of the trilogy, the Three Flavors Cornetto trilogy that started with Shaun of the Dead in 2004 and had Hot Fuzz in the middle of 2007.
Ever had one of those nights that starts out like any other, but ends up being the best night of your life? I did. Our goal that night was simple. 12 pubs, 12 pints. From the first post to the world's end. But that night, we never made it.
I saw the boys the other day.
Uh-huh.
We're going to go back to Newton Haven.
Why?
5 guys, 12 pubs, 50 pints. 60 pints.
Steady on, you Alky.
This is our chance to finally finish what we started.
No.
We are going to do the Golden Mile, and this time
we are going to see it through to the bitter end. Or lager end.
Good evening, Raymondo. The prodigal son's return.
Hi.
What do you recommend?
Beer.
Mmm.
One tap water.
What? What the hell is this? Why are we even here?
We are here to get annihilated.
You come back and everything's sort of weird.
I suggest you get on your way.
It's not us that's changed. It's the town.
We are going to get to the world's end if it kills us. Welcome home, boys.
Oh, no.
end.
What do we do? Let's finish our drinks.
All right, so this is definitely a fair, again, apocalyptic storytelling movie. This movie is about Gary King, played by Simon Pegg. He's basically gotten the boys together, his high school boys together, to complete a pub crawl. And it's all in their hometown, and it all culminates at the World's End, which is the last pub in the pub crawl. And it's been years since their last night of high school when they went and tried to do the pub crawl. But now he wants to come back and pull the game together. And clearly the rest of them have moved on with their lives, and they have not necessarily fulfilling lives, but they do definitely have grown-up lives. And he has never changed. He still is just like he was back then, and he wants to get them together and try it one last time. Well, for me, this movie, I'm really kind of torn. This movie definitely gets 3 stars because I did like this movie, but I'm not sure if I should give it 4 stars or not, and here is why. This movie is played off as kind of an apocalyptic comedy with some light action thrown in, just like Shaun of the Dead was, just like Hot Fuzz, although Hot Fuzz isn't exactly apocalyptic, but you know. See, the thing is, though, is that the movie is not really all that funny. It's not bad, but it's not all that funny either. It's almost like the movie is a statement on the way Gary looks at life and is trying to recreate it, but like you really never can go home again. And also how we look at trilogies as viewers of cinema and expecting major spectacle and an awesome story being brought to a close, and then it doesn't quite deliver. And I can't decide if they did it intentionally or not, because they get to a point where they're hinting at stuff throughout the whole movie about Gary's real motivation for what's going on with this, and I don't want to spoil it for you because they do give it away at the end of the movie. And then when you see the culmination of the motivations here and how the movie does play out in its final moments at the climax of the movie, just before the denouement, you kind of feel like, man, it's almost like an allegory for how we're looking at this, and also how when people try to recreate their high school years or their college years, the salad days of life, and they find that it's not as good as what they was, what they thought was important then and what was fun for them has changed over the years. And I can't decide whether or not they did that intentionally. If he did in fact do it intentionally, 4 stars, awesome, because it came across brilliantly. If that's just what I'm taking away from it because I'm wanting to see it, 3 stars. Because it's not as funny as it should be. The movie doesn't drag, per se. It's doing its job in storytelling, and the pacing falls a little flat. Not enough, again, to make it drag. Not enough to make it slow. But the pacing falls short of the comedic high points that they have. And then they have more... You get a little bit more of the action going on towards the end of the movie, because as they're going through their pub crawl, they realize that the town has changed, because the town has been more or less taken over by an artificial intelligence, let's just say, that is an alien intelligence and is basically replacing pockets of the world to try and make the world a better place and makes nice robotic people. The action does build. You do get a lot of laughs, but they space them out, and you're expecting more from the beginning than what you're given in terms of comedy. You do get there at the end. The journey is more than the destination for this movie. And again, I have to say, if that was the intent, was to write it in that style and to kind of give you that you never really can go home again, and to kind of give you that feel of being a little awkward on purpose, then that was brilliant writing, because that's what I walked away from with it, and that's why I would give it 4 stars. If that was not intentional, then I gotta give it 3 stars, because it's not as funny as they present it, and you will notice that the pacing is off throughout the movie. Even though it's hit and miss, I still like this movie. I'm definitely glad I saw it, and that is what I have to say.
Yeah, I agree with you. Pretty much. The only thing I will actually add, the main downfall for this movie for me, I think, was that the second act became pretty repetitive to where by that time they were just in the groove of just going to the next bar, dodging the robots, get to the next bar, we lost somebody, dodge the robots, fight the robots, get to the next bar, that whole kind of setup. I think this is definitely a movie that I have to watch it again to give it a fair rating, because I was really looking forward to this movie, and then the hype just got out of control, to where it kind of, I think hearing too much about this movie and hearing too many of the details about the movie, some of the twists were kind of spoiled, and I was able to look for certain things and I was able to guess, and pretty much everything I kind of came up with except the very end is pretty much what happened. But I enjoyed it. I think I'll give it 3 to 3.5, but I gotta see this one again.
All right then. Man, I'm pretty sure that our review of Melancholia was as long as the damn movie, if we're closing out with The World's End and it took less than 5 minutes.
No, exactly.
Oh my goodness. All right, well then that closes out the movies. The movies for next week are going to be Two Guns, Insidious, and The Girl from Petrovka. Insidious is not on Netflix, but we are definitely going out of our way to see this movie because we're very excited for what's coming next in the Insidious world. Two Guns is still in the theaters, and then The Girl from Petrovka is going to be on Netflix for you. And, of course, next week, again, not doing 3 Squared, but we are doing the discussion. And discussion for next week is going to be over the controversial, so controversial it was never released movie by Jerry Lewis called The Day the Clown Cried. And I encourage you all to look up that movie. I'm not going to tell you anything about it. But this was so controversial, it was never released. This is Jerry Lewis. Come on. Hello, lady. I mean, you know, that is where it's at. So we're going to be doing our discussion on that, and then 3 Squared will be back in 2 weeks. So I believe, if that is all, it is time for the spiel, is it not, sir?
Spiel on.
Alrighty, sir. The music that you've been listening to, as always, is provided to us by our music partners, Cries of Solace. You can check them out at criesofsolace.com. You can always also check them out at reverbnation.com, myspace.com, and facebook.com/criesofsolace. You can also check us out, because, you know, it's our show, right? The SLS cast, you can check us out at slscast.com, no www. You can send us an email to theslscast@gmail.com. You can even go to facebook.com and search us there for the SLS cast, and you can follow us on Twitter at theslscast, and of course, subscribe to us on iTunes. So, until next week, this is Matt saying that thanks to Joan Crawford, I get to say, I never go outside unless I look like Joan Crawford, the movie star. If you want to see The Girl Next Door, go next door.
Oh, puts my life into perspective. Cheers, guys.
Have a good one.
Thanks again for listening to the SLS Cast with your hosts, Matt and Tim. Remember that you can find us at slscast.com, at the SLS Cast for Twitter, also on Facebook, and you can always subscribe on iTunes. Thanks again for listening.